It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, I'll talk with John Sutter of the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. We'll talk about their new one-of-a-kind exhibit, Turtles, Secrets of the Shell, and their missing leopard tortoise, Cashew. But first, award-winning poet and playwright Cornelius Eady is here. He is the author of 8 books of poetry. His 2001 book, Brutal Imagination, was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's also the co-founder of the Kava Khanum Foundation, an organization committed to cultivating the artistic and professional growth of African-American poets. He is a professor of English and theater at the University of Missouri at Columbia. His latest release is Book of Hooks, Volumes 1 and 2, and he is performing this afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Clinton Street Social Club in Iowa City as part of the Mission Creek Festival. Cornelius Eady, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I love in the introduction to Book of Hooks, you write about being a teenager in Rochester, New York, and discovering the world of music. And then, again, this is a musical release, not just poetry.
Yes.
But you write about you becoming infatuated with music, but not really having that much access, and sitting at the library in Rochester, New York, and listening to songs. And I love that image, but I found it really interesting to think about how, for so many people, poetry and music is inseparable. But for you, even at that age, it seemed that you understood that there was a difference.
Well, yes, I wrote poetry, and I wrote songs before I wrote poetry. And that was because, like any other teenage kid, I was really into, the pop, listening to music, right? There was lots of stuff. Actually, AM radio back at that time was a lot more, diverse, as we say now, than it is now, right? So AM radio, you could hear anything. Broadway show tunes, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, instrumental stuff, all within an hour, right? I mean, because, someone asked me a couple days ago, what was the first time I heard jazz? And it actually had to be Stan Getz, actually playing Girl from Ipanema, right? I mean, because I didn't realize that's who he was, but that's when I think about it. And where did I hear it? On AM radio. So all of these different sort of influences came in, but I was also but poetry was something slightly different, right? Because I was that precocious nerdy kid who went up to the AV, but then I went downstairs to the stacks, and that was poetry, right? And that was a totally different feel to me, right? The stuff that's on the page is written for the page, as opposed to something that has to be sung and put to music.
It surprised me, though, thinking about you as a teenager writing lyrics to songs, and then deciding that you wanted to write poetry as a separate thing.
Yeah.
What made your poetry as a teenager? Because a lot of us wrote, you probably wrote better poetry as a teenager than
really.
A lot of us do.
Not
but,
really.
But teenage poetry is sort of a special thing in and of itself.
Yeah.
What in your teenage mind made poetry different from songs?
Well, it wasn't really a difference. They complemented each other to me, and they still do. I mean, you can hear that. If you listen to the CD, you can actually hear how that's actually working for me. I didn't think of them as two separate things. I thought they sort of flew between each other, right? They kind of influence one another, right? A good poem, actually, to me, is something that has its own kind of music to it. And I'm going, and I guess as a kid, I was trying to figure out just what they were doing. Like, for example, I'd be reading Allen Ginsberg's Howl, for example, and I'm a teenager and I don't even know what the hell he's talking about, right? I mean, I was 12, 13 years old when I first encountered Howl, and the only reason I'd read Howl was because I saw this incredibly cute book. City Lights had this, the black and white cover, and it looks kind of cool. So graphically, I was drawn to it, and I start reading it, and it's unlike anything I read, I've been reading up to that point, which is Robert Frost and whatever they shoved down your throat in high school, right? So suddenly, I'm realizing that there's this incredible just music coming out of this poetry, and this is I want to do that, So I'm trying to figure out how is he, as a writer, I started figuring out how does Ginsberg do that? How does he get that really long line, that big breath that he's taking? Now, at the time, I didn't realize that I was also reading Whitman, and I was also reading Blake and all the other stuff that Ginsberg had been reading. But there was a certain kind of energy that's not really song, but a different kind of song. And I was trying to figure out on the line. So I would do things like, I had journals. You go back talking about, you know, how your my teenage poetry had to be better than yours. I can tell you, I can guarantee you. But if I ever find out I'm going to have a terminal disease, I'm going to die, they all burn, okay? They all go into a nice little barn fire and up they go because they're horrible, you know? But what I would do basically, what I was doing is trying to work out the nuts and bolts of what that long line was about, right? So, for example, I would go into the There is a little park next to Xerox Tower, which is one of the big, you know, companies in Rochester, or at least it was for a while. And I'd watch the executives go down for brown bag lunches. It was summer or spring, and I'd be writing in my little journal, these plastic executives in their three-piece suits, they do not live, they cannot breathe, they don't understand, they have no, you know, and there's horrible, horrible lines. But if you looked at it physically, you see this long line, right? And that's me trying to figure out, how does that line work? Right? How do you get all that information into a long breath? So I understood in some ways that's the kind of music that I wanted to get, but it wasn't a singing, you know, but it wasn't about singing. Lyrics are a different deal for me. They're something that's more concise. They have to be dependent on something like a melody. It has to be sung. So I was working both things at the same, both muscles at the same time.
Well, and you have done things musically throughout your career. It strikes me that more for fun than in seriousness in many ways.
Well, I was semi-serious about music. I've always been, like I said, I've always carried it with me. So, if you do it for a long time, you're serious about it, you know? I mean, if you don't let go of it, you're serious about it. And but you're right. At a certain point, for a number of reasons, I think, poetry got the upper hand, you know? It just seemed to be the path I was going to take, you know? There's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, you know, but it just seemed at some point I simply realized that this is what I do. This is all I really want to do. Is I want to be a writer. I want to write, you know, and I really want to figure out what that means, what it is to be a poet. So at a certain point, the paths diverged, you know, but I never fully let go of that.
This project seems kind of to have come full circle, though, and bringing you back in some ways to that teenage boy and his guitar, who didn't know how to play, but yeah, now you do.
Well, I play better. I'm lucky in the sense that on Book of Hooks, I have some really, really, really fine musicians on them, on the songs, and and I'm better at it. You know, right? I'm not the kid who walks around with an untuned guitar just for the effect of looking like a musician. But
what made you want to set these poems to music?
Well. It this starts off basically because I've been doing, like I said, I've been doing this all along, right? It's just you know, compiling stuff. I got a four-track Tascam recorder. People will know that stuff when I'm talking about. It was a cassette player back in 1985. And I was living in Lynchburg, Virginia then, and I just started doing a lot of songs, right? You know, and of course, part of this is also the very human sort of like, you know, thing of I'll get to it eventually. Some point I'll take these work songs and turn them into something else. And years go by and years go by, and I move back to New York, and I take the machine with me, and I start doing some other stuff, and I keep playing songs. And at a certain point, I'm at the age now where libraries want to take my papers, right? And they said, we want to buy your papers. And I go through all my files and I realize I have all these songs. I have over 120, 30 songs, right? And I suddenly realized I should do something with this. You know, I really ought to do something with this. Instead of just putting it in a box and sending it off to some library where it'll never be seen again for another 50 years until some grad student stumbles upon them, I said, I should finish these up. So I started working on, firstly, the idea was simply just to rehabilitate the old songs. But the more I got into it, the more I realized that I wanted to write new stuff.
All right. And was there something about the poems that you ended up setting to music that made them different from your other poetry?
Oh, what makes them different is what makes them different just for me is that, you know, there's a difference between reciting and singing. They're both singing, but they're different. But they're different. They come from different parts of the voice, different parts of the throat. So I was going to look. I'm looking for things that are going to fit a certain kind of arrangement. And the and the And the for me, the sort of challenge or the excitement of it was finding the arrangement for the words, you know. Or when I write songs, basically what happens is happens in reverse. You're thinking that I write the poem and then I find the music for it. But 9 times out of 10, usually I write the music first and then find the lyric to fit it.
Interesting. Well, yeah. We're going to have to take a short break, but before we get to the break, I want to play one of these tracks so people know what we're talking okay. about. And let's start with one of the really fun tracks off the collection. This is Mark and Time.
I was walking down Lola Street, checking out the empty storefronts, when this woman walked up to me. She said it's heaven or it's hell, and what's the difference? World ain't gonna run, it's a big dead end sign. Think you're doing so fine, but you're just marking time. I said, lady, it ain't my fault. This mess was around when I got here. Well, she looked me over from head to toe, then run me down with a voice so clear. She said, if I had a bomb, well, I just wipe you off. If I had a broom, I'd sweep you out the room.
Mark and Time, Cornelius Eady from his new release, Book of Hooks, Volumes 1 and 2. I'll continue my conversation with poet, playwright, and musician Cornelius Eady in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Coming up at 11, Fresh Air with Terry Gross, life as a Mormon missionary going door-to-door proselytizing when you have doubts about your faith. Talk with Ryan McKelvin, author of the new novel, Elders. For the rest of today, a partly sunny sky, warmer weather, as warm as 65 today in southwest Iowa, 48 in the far north. Mostly clear tonight, the lows 25 to 35. And tomorrow, partly sunny, highs 45 northeast to 65 degrees tomorrow in the southwest. Winds are generally out of the west-southwest at about 10 to 15 miles per hour. The sky is sunny, a few clouds in northwest Iowa, and currently in the Quad Cities, 53 degrees. It's 52 in Ottumwa, 45 in Cedar Falls, Waterloo, 46 in Cedar Rapids, Iowa City at 47 degrees. It's 44 degrees in Ames, and in Des Moines, 48 degrees.
Support comes from your U.S. Cellular authorized agent, striving to keep you connected to everything that's important to you. Highway 1 and Riverside Drive, Iowa City, Williamsburg, Washington, and Fairfield. U.S. Cellular authorized agent. Hello, better.
The war in Afghanistan is now in its 12th year. What will happen when international forces finally leave? I'm Ben Kiefer. Next time on River to River, we'll get a view from my guest, veteran journalist Peter Eichstadt, who is visiting Iowa. For his new book, Above the Din of War, Eichstadt crisscrossed Afghanistan, interviewing an array of people, former warlords, would-be suicide bombers, and frightened mullahs. Next time on River to River, weekdays at noon.
Support comes from the Lux Zone and Jan Finlayson Designs. Locally owned, offering fine furnishings, gifts, and customized interior design at Coralville's Plaza on 5th. More at theluxzone.com. Memorable places start here.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is award-winning poet, playwright, and musician Cornelius Eady. He's here with us today because he's in Iowa City for the Mission Creek Festival. He'll be performing this afternoon at 5 at the Clinton Street Social Club in Iowa City. And we were just listening to a little bit of music from this new release, Book of Hooks, Volume 1 and 2. And I want to start off this segment also with listening to another, just a part of another one of the songs. And this is a song that you wrote for Trayvon Martin.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, of course, a young black man who was killed
yeah.
while he was out making a run to a convenience store in Florida. One of the things that I really enjoy about this collection is that you give us a little bit of a description of why you wrote what you wrote. And so often with poetry, you either get it or you don't. And if you don't get it, you're out of luck. But you're willing to give us a little bit of a hand here. And one of the interesting things about this selection was that you wrote that it was really difficult to write, not just because you were so upset, but because it just seemed like one more time you had to deal with the same thing again. What was your response?
Well, that was it. It was exhaustion. I mean, to be quite honest about it, you know. When I heard it, I just went, oh, again and again and again and again, you know. And it was almost like a saturation point, you know. And then I heard a commentary on another NPR station talk about his exhaustion about it. And it spurred me to start writing about it because I realized I couldn't just not say anything about it, even though I felt like I was doing, you know, it just felt overwhelming, right? Also, I had an incident where one of my students, where I teach right now at the University of Missouri, called me up during around this time. Called me up, a great student, you know, called me up and said, "Professor Eady, I can't come in today. Something's come up." And it was a Monday. And on Wednesday, he comes in and he's bruised, right? And he doesn't really talk about it. Now, on Tuesdays, I usually have an open house at my house in Missouri when I'm there on campus for all comers, usually my students, but for anybody. And a little after that, he told me, came to one of the open houses and told me what had happened, that he had been parking his car where he works, not on campus, but where he works in Columbia, Missouri, and a cop car pulls up and says, you were speeding. You were speeding in the garage. And the kid misunderstood that because he thought he had the right to talk back to the cop, right? So he talked back to the cop. He was like, "Listen, man, I don't know what that is, but I'm my car is parked now, and I'm going off to work. I'm see you later." And it stops. He stops the kid. The kid goes up. It escalates. He gets arrested. He gets beaten up. And I realized that could have been him. That really could have been. That could have gone south. It did go south, but it could have really gone south so easily, so quickly, for speeding in a garage. I mean, so it was those two things together. So I felt like that idea of just how quickly this could happen, you know. So, you know, I mean, right, Trayvon was just going for Skittles. He was going to do a skill run. It was halftime. He was going to go off and get something for it, maybe his brother, his cousin or something like that. And now I've got some Skittles and was in the wrong thing. And the, you know, when I played with other people back in Rochester, we sometimes had we do parody songs, right? And so I had a parody of Woody Guthrie's "This Land Is Your Land," right? It'd be like, "This land is my land, it isn't your land. Get out of my land, it's only my land. What are you doing in my land? This land was made for only me." I mean, we do little parodies. So when that happened, I started thinking about, this is kind of like that, isn't it? It's kind of like the guy saying, you know, "This is my territory, and you can get a death sentence by making me uncomfortable. You make me nervous, and then I'm going to kill you. It's my land." So that was the genesis of the song.
Let's listen to a little bit. This is "Walking" (parentheses) yeah. "While Black."
"This land is my land. What you doing here? Black boy in your hood. What you doing here? Black boy from the hood. Black dog sniffing at a bone. Black boy walking through a store. Wonder what he did. Something in his pocket. Wonder what he hid. My land's called nervous, baby. There's no room for tourists.
winners and losers.
You gotta watch for the devil. Think we the devil with a gun. You gotta watch for the devil. Think we the devil with a gun. You gotta watch for the devil. Think we the devil with a gun. You gotta keep your eyes peeled for the devil. And then shoot the devil as he runs. You gotta chase the devil. Then make the devil cry. You gotta come as you see it. As he goes walking by.
Haters and losers.
A little bit of Walking While Black by Cornelius Eady from his new release, Book of Hooks, Volume 1 and 2. And you're also one of the co-founders of the Kaveh Kanem Foundation, which is an organization that tries to help young African-American poets, or probably not that young find their way artistically. Do you think that the world of literature is welcoming to African-American writers today?
That's a complicated question, okay? And I'm not, I mean, and we haven't got a lot of time, so I want to go into a long discussion about that. But the reason Kaveh Kanem came into existence is because there was a need for it. That's the quick, short answer for that, right? Toy Derricott, who was the other co-founder of Kaveh Kanem, and I just sort of realize that, you know, there was just, you know, you can be an African American in a MFA program or, you know, in literature, but there's no sense, there's this feeling that you're not quite fully there, or you question the reasons why you're there, or so it's there to give a space where there wasn't a space, you know, and that was the response we had to that, you know, to the idea. I mean, there's, again, it's a complicated, race is always a complicated issue in this country, you know. But Toy and I really felt that was a necessity, and we didn't realize when we started Kaveh Kanem back in 1996, just how deeply it ran. We were just trying to have a workshop, you know, and the first summer, the very first year we did it. The response to that by the participants was just overwhelming. Toyo always tells a story, which is very true because we both felt this, that once we opened the space, they claimed the space. You know, Toy would be walking around saying, who's running this? You know, but it was like they simply said it was like hungry people getting some nourishment that they hadn't had before. And it was a little, you know, just overwhelming in a way. But we realized that we had struck something that was needed.
When I look back over your career, you've taught in many, many different places. And and one of the things that kind of struck me about that, I mean, you've spent a lot of time in New York, but also South Bend, Indiana, and now you're in Missouri. And that must give you an interesting picture of race in America, living in all of these different communities and these different academic communities. Yeah. I mean, Notre Dame is a very different academic community from many
Dame
others.
Notre Dame is unique. It's a very unique space. It is unlike any place else I've ever taught. And you really can't understanding Notre Dame is like trying to explain New York to somebody who doesn't live in New York fully, right? You think you know it from a distance, but not until you actually live there, but you're a little apprehensive about what it's about. Notre Dame's the same way. I really love teaching there. I want to preface by all that by saying that I had a really great time, was there for 5 years, but it's a unique situation. And you're right. I've been realizing lately that I primarily live in New York. But I teach in the Midwest, you know. So I commute. I commute weekly. I was commuting from Notre Dame, and now I'm commuting from Missouri. So I wake up one day in the red state, and I go to the blue state. Wake up one day in the blue state, and go over to a red state. So you get to see how the country is operating on these different levels. Yeah.
Has that informed your work?
It does. It informs it in a way that you know, I haven't fully I've fully digested yet as a writer, but it's definitely there.
I want to talk about another track from this collection, and maybe we can start by just listening to a little bit of the next selection. And this is called "A Poet Forgets His Library."
Books to Sometimes I think they're talking about me. All this time, all this time, all this time it seems. They say it has no memory. A poet forgets his libraries. Something was written long ago. Voice I should know says it was written by me. Something like a hymn, almost holy song. Some face on the cover, but they've got it all wrong. Tell me what this nonsense has to do with me. All this time, all this time, all this time at sea. They say it has no memory. A poet forgets his life.
Just a little bit of A Poet Forgets His Library by Cornelius Eady. And that was inspired by something that was going on in real life.
Yeah, right. But I also want you seem to like notes, behind-the-scene notes.
I do.
Yeah, right. Well, I'll give you a little insight on that track. The woman going, me, is Rita Hayworth. Rita Hayworth and Gilda.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because for two reasons. One was that there's a – it was fun. We thought it would be kind of cool to find it, and we found it while we were mixing the song. But the other thing is that there's another song on the CD about Rita Hayworth, a story about her being on the set of her last film. And they thought she was just being a drunken diva, but actually it was Alzheimer's, onset of her Alzheimer's. And so – because this is about Alzheimer's, I decided to throw Rita in as this kind of like a cameo appearance. But there was a poet who is going through Alzheimer's right now, and that was the motivation of this. I read an article in the New York Times about the poet, and he'd gotten to the point where he was forgetting his own work. That people would come up and say, this is your work, and he would not recognize the work. And I just thought, wow, that's an interesting, that's an odd moment to think about. So that started the work towards the
track. Well, it certainly fires the imagination because, I mean, part of writing, and I would say even maybe especially in poetry, is putting part of yourself into your work, and it's there forever. I mean, you've put this feeling, this idea, this place, this time on paper, and it can never go away.
Yeah.
But it's such an interesting thought to think about losing that in your own mind, but still having that.
I know. So that was the dilemma, and I thought, I couldn't not write about that. And that was one of the songs that actually started off as lyrics. And I actually did write it out as a lyric and then sent it to my friend Bernie Hevron, who was the producer of the CD. And he set the music to that one.
Having written all of these songs and spent so much time, I'm sure, working on the music for this collection, now when you're thinking about future projects, where are you headed? Are you working on music? Are you working on poetry?
I'm always working on something, right? Yeah, I'm working. I am working on poetry. The project took 2 years to finish once we really got started, which is interesting. I mean, 2 years not because I was so deeply into the project, but 2 years between teaching and flying back and forth and doing readings and this other stuff. So. It took 2 years to do that, and I'm hoping that the next time we do this, it won't take 2 years, but who knows, right? Out of this came a band, what I call a literary band. We call Rough Magic, and from Shakespeare and the Tempest. And it was some of the New York players. Robin Messing, who is a singer and also a novelist and short story writer and poet, and her daughter Emma Alabaster and some other friends of Emma's, who play on a lot of the tracks, we started playing live, and that's becoming an ongoing thing. In fact, unfortunately, there wasn't enough money to get me and the band here to play tonight, but we are playing out, and so that's something else is going to happen. How I think it's going to inform the next recording I do.
That collection of sounds, of music that you had sitting in your box, do you feel like you've you've completed what you need to complete
No. That's a fraction of the songs that I never finished, right? So I think the next one will probably start appearing again, right? I mean, there's a marking time with one of those songs, right? Actually, we recorded the basic tracks of that 1990 in Rochester. The guitar, vocal, and harmonica part was all done in Rochester 1990, and then finished it up with Marvin Sewell on guitar, last year. So it's there'll be more of those, coming in, mixed in with all the new stuff that I'm writing.
In many of your works in the past, you've been able to go from extremely serious subjects to really humorous subjects, from, writing about your schizophrenic mother to writing about somebody with terrible fashion sense. And does the music give you even more leeway to do, the really tough stuff and have a lot of fun, too?
Yeah. It's fun. Definitely. The factor here is fun. I really think that I am, this is like doing theater to me. And theater is really tough, but it's also fun to me. And it felt that way when I was getting to the studio and I was doing those episodes. This really feels like doing a play. It really feels like I'm just working on another play. But I really enjoy it. I really have a lot of fun. And luckily, the people that I'm working with are having a lot of fun, too. So it's mutual.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Well, we're going to go out with some fun here in just a second. Stone Cold Jane is the track about fellow professor who does roller derby.
Right. There are two tracks on Book of Hooks that I have not written otherwise. Last year I was in Brazil, and I wrote a song called Allison that I wouldn't have written if I hadn't been in Brazil. And Stone Cold Jane, if I hadn't gotten the job at Missouri, I'd never have written this song, because I ran into Devaney Lusa, who is my colleague there, and she really is a roller derby professor.
That's great. Well, Cornelius Edie, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right. And we will go out with Stone Cold Jane. Cornelius Edie is in Iowa for the Mission Creep Festival. He'll be performing this afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Clinton Street Social Club in Iowa City.
The girl likes to roll, got her rock star skates on the flat track.